Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode. Our burning questions for today are all about advocacy. So question one is, what kind of advocacy is needed for English language learners? And our second question is, how do we center the voices of our L's and their families in our advocacy? I have a special guest here today, like a sister colleague here today with me, Jennifer Rapponi. Hi, Jen.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so glad that you were able to do this. I would love for our listeners to know a little bit about you. So can you first start by telling us what your title or your role is in your current position?
Sure. I am a professional development specialist. I work for the Midwest Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network. Our office is located in Spencerport, New York, but we cover the 67 school districts of the Monroe 1, 2, GV, and Wayne Finger Lakes BOCES regions, plus the city of Rochester. So we're actually the smallest Arvern region.
And when you say it like that, it's like, oh yeah. My gosh, it's so much.
Yeah, we're actually the smallest, so, but we, it's a big job.
It is. Jen, what are your special areas of interest or research in your position, and even outside of that, when you were a classroom teacher?
Mm-hmm. So I had kind of a winding journey to become an ESL teacher. I started out going to college to be a midwife, and I just wasn't connecting with the classes, and I eventually became a speech therapist. I worked as a speech therapist for several years before I went and got my master's in TESOL. So I currently hold four teacher certifications, actually. So a certification for the speech and hearing handicapped, my K-12 certification for TESOL, and I have a second master's in literacy with B-12 certification in literacy. So my areas of expertise and really interest are literacy for English language learners, helping students with interrupted formal education, and then my coaching teachers over the last 8 years that I've worked for Arvern has really led me to think about how to support teachers social emotionally and to help them develop the leadership skills they need to be advocates. So I spend a lot of time helping teachers learn how to be leaders, which I love.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. And I'm sure they're grateful to have you because you have so much experience, so much different experience, I think, than a lot of teachers who are ENL teachers, which is really cool. So you've had all of these unique experiences. What drew you to working with ELLs? Why did you go back and get that master's?
So I love language. I loved language teaching. I really loved working with kids as a speech therapist, but the thing about first language acquisition is that it's really set for English in particular. Like you learn it in a particular order. You do like the Brown's 14 morphemes and they come 1 through 14 and you have this sound by this particular age and this sound by this particular age. And after about 5 years of it, and the therapy is very repetitive. So you have cases of kids that come up over and over again, like, oh, I have to fix a lisp or whatever. I worked primarily with preschool age students, so I did lots of vocabulary development and helping kids answer WH questions and put together sentences. And after 5 years, I really felt like I had exhausted my ability to grow as a professional because it's so heavily researched and so scripted that, you know, there's not a lot of new exciting things that are happening. Well, weren't at the time. I don't know now because I'm not practicing. New and exciting things that were happening. And I did a lot of reflecting about when is the last time I felt really challenged and excited about my job. And part of becoming a speech therapist is that in your undergrad program, you have to do 250 clinical hours across a variety of topics. So stuttering, voice problems, swallowing, articulation, things like that. And I had done some of my hours in my college clinic. And my clients in the clinic were international students. So part of the international program at SUNY Geneseo where I went at the time was that they were required to go to speech clinic and they could set their own goals. So it was part of their English learning process. They could set their own goals in clinics. So some people wanted accent reduction. Some people wanted help with vocabulary development. Some people wanted basic interpersonal communication skills. So I worked with several of my clients at the time with like interview skills because they were graduating. So we would, you know, practice resume writing and I would pose as the interviewee and ask them questions. And we would really kind of help them craft their language to show themselves in the best possible light in the job market. And I loved it. And I was good enough at it apparently that like people knew, international students knew who I was on campus. Like, so I would be walking across the quad and they would be like, Jennifer, and I would be like, hi, who I assume you're like a friend of my clients or whatever. So so I decided really to look into TESOL programs and see what that would be like. And I also very social justice is very important to me. So I specifically looked for social justice oriented programs. And I ended up at the University of Rochester for my TESOL master's. They have a really social justice focused master's program. And so I decided that was, you know, this was where I needed to be. And I really haven't looked back. It's second language learning is so different. It's so much grayer. Like it depends a lot on what your first language skills are, language and literacy skills. And I sort of liken it to, it's not so scripted. You know, you present kids with like learning situations and then they acquire the language necessary to be able to be involved in that. And it's so much different than like fixing our distortion. It's so much more challenging. I've never, I think the blessing and the curse of being an ESL teacher is like, you can make it whatever you want, right? And for some people that's really overwhelming. And for me, that's just, that's the challenge that I need. I need to be intellectually stimulated. I need to be learning all the time. I need to be honing my skills. And you have a different grade level or a different set of languages than your classroom or, you know, a different set of needs every year. So there's never one particular curriculum or way of teaching that you can be attached to. So I've never been bored in all the time that I've been doing this.
That's really cool. It's really interesting for me to get to hear that perspective about the speech development in the first language and kind of trying to support kids who are maybe having some struggles there versus working with English language learners. It's really cool to hear that articulated by you. I know when I was in grad school, I took a class that I had to take as an elective or something, anatomy of the speech mechanism, and everybody mm-hmm. who was in the class was going to school to become a speech pathologist. And I thought that class was so cool just to learn about that piece. But
yeah.
You know, it's cool how it's connected and yet it's so different. I think that's really interesting. Well, thanks for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's jump into our burning question number one of the day. What kind of advocacy is needed for ELLs? And I want to start out by asking you, Jen, how do you define advocacy?
Yeah, so that's so funny. I was, we have our guiding questions that we're thinking about, and I spend a lot of time thinking about this. And, I was looking at definitions of advocacy. And so Webster's Dictionary defines advocacy as someone who pleads the cause of another. And very specific, I don't necessarily think that encompasses what it is that we need to be doing with our students. What that definition for me leaves out is the voice of students and parents, which is so important. And I think that's a step in the sequence of advocacy. So for me, my definition would be working toward an equitable education for English language learners by fostering or supporting the voice of students and their families.
I love that. I think that that is something that for me individually is a hard balance to strike. You know, what, and we're going to get into this with questions that I've gathered from other people and that I've heard teachers ask throughout their careers. You know, at what point is it me just taking up space where someone else's voice needs to be heard versus me making a space for someone else's voice to be heard? I think that's really challenging. So I'm looking forward to talking about that. Mm-hmm. So before we kind of talk about that kind of really complicated piece, let's just get a list going. Can we get a list maybe?
Yes.
What do we need Absolutely. To advocate about or for? What are some things that you think, in your opinion, we need to advocate about?
So I think shared sense of responsibility for L students is a huge piece of advocacy. I also think full inclusion into school communities of both students and parents are also really huge pieces of advocacy. And I sort of think all of the little things that fall under that, like, you know, are lessons being scaffolded, are assessments available to students in a language they understand, for me, fall under those two umbrellas, really. That my two main goals are that everyone in a school system has a sense of responsibility for English language learners, from all the way from the substitute teacher to the president of the board, that they're on everybody's radar and they're being thought about in decision making and in the day-to-day practices of that school system. And I think as a result of that, helping students and their families be fully included into a school community is really important.
And that sentiment is definitely reflected in our blueprint for L success that the state has. So I don't know, some listeners may not be familiar with that, but that shared responsibility, that idea that all teachers are teachers of L's, is something that I think we hope that more people hear and take to heart. And I think that this episode will really maybe give them some concrete ways to kind of own that statement. Yeah. So what are some methods of advocacy? How do we do this?
So I think that there are some steps to really think about. So the first thing that we need to think about is identifying barriers, right? What are the barriers to a shared sense of responsibility and full inclusion into a school community? You know, what's getting in the way? Are parents not able to access teachers or materials because of language? Are your fellow classroom and content teachers have not been professionally trained to scaffold? Is there no expectation from the top down that anybody is responsible for English language learners other than the ESL teacher? So I think identifying your barriers is one. A really big, important kind of step to think about advocacy first. And then you're thinking about potential solutions to those barriers. And you know, there are tons of them. I think identifying your allies is really key. And I don't necessarily know that these need to all go in a particular order. I just think that, you know, these are the steps that you go through. So even in a community like the ones that I serve, so our Auburn region, much like yours, covers a large part of rural New York State. And I don't know if this is true for you or not, but 10 years ago when I was in the classroom, I taught in a rural classroom, and it was very, very common to have a singleton ESL teacher. That is not common anymore. It's actually quite rare to have a district with no L's or only a couple of two or three or four L's that are covered by one ESL teacher. the school that I used to work in went from having 1.5 teachers to now 3, and they're probably going to need 3.5 over the last 5 years.
Our region still has a lot of areas that have one teacher for a whole district, or we have many itinerant teachers in our mm-hmm. region who serve multiple districts. And so we definitely have some questions that I think relate to those kind of experiences, but can mm-hmm. apply to the experiences of teachers yeah. who work. Hopefully, like, I think it's so great to be able to work with other ENL teachers as an ENL teacher. And I've luckily had both experiences. Yeah. So I know what it's like to be alone, and I know what it's like to have a team. So I think we'll definitely have some questions about specifically for those poor teachers all by themselves.
Yeah. I think your team's your first best allies, right? So when you have a team, you have that, that added advantage that you have kind of a baked in set of people that hopefully have similar values and similar teaching outlooks, and that you can bounce ideas off of each other. So your team's your first best ally. If you don't have a team, you can look, you know, regionally. New York State is organized by BOCES regions. And so I actually got this job at Arbor, and because I so desperately needed a team that I created one myself. So I started holding ESL regional team meetings at my local BOCES. And I invited Arbor to come and speak at, they were BTAC at the time, something else, but invited them to come and speak, and you know, we used each other and the 3 full days of PD we had each year to really you know, think about the problems and the barriers to an equitable education together, and then kind of create solutions together.
I love that you said that, because I feel like there's a little bit of fear maybe sometimes, like teachers, I really want all teachers, in particular ENL teachers, to think of themselves as leaders. And I feel like they might think in that kind of situation, like, oh, I don't know if I'm the right person to do this, but really mm-hmm. if you want to do it, you're the right person to do it. And I think there's so much power in saying, I need a community. There isn't currently one. I'm going to make one. I really love that.
Yeah. And I think we so naturally do this outside of our profession, right? Like, say you want to learn piano, or you want to learn how to speak French. I mean, there's a coffee shop around my house that has a French meetup group every Saturday. Humans are connecting animals. We need community to survive. And so we look for community outside of our job. We don't often look for community inside of our job. And I think that finding that community are your allies. And I think your team, again, is your first best community. But, you know, there are classroom teachers and administrators and community members that might feel the same way. And I think we should feel comfortable saying, hey, I feel this way. I would like some help. Who else is interested in getting together and really thinking through some solutions for these barriers that we've identified? And when a teacher, any teacher, steps up to that leadership role, I've never, in all the years I've been doing this, have heard of anybody say, I can't get a team together. Mm-hmm. People are more than willing to sit down. They just have to be invited to the table.
I love that. So in addition to, you know, figuring out what those barriers are and talking about solutions with your allies, are there any other steps or methods that you think people can use to advocate?
Yeah, so I would recommend that when you think about what your largest barriers are and what your possible solutions are, to really focus on one at a time. So think about the one that's the most important. So there's this principle in business called the 80-20 principle. And it's the idea that like one change that you picking one change that will have the greatest amount of impact. So if you change this one thing, then 80% of your business is going to change. I think we could carry that over into advocacy. So we're thinking about what's the one thing that we can work on right now that has the greatest impact on our ability to serve our kids and put our energy into that. And then when that's done, move to the next item on the list. I also think relationships are really, really important in order to be an effective advocate. So you have to be a trusted voice, which means you have to be a trustworthy person, you know, that you're keeping your word, that you're not emotionally overreacting, that, you know, that you're, you know, a calm and steady voice. And in terms of that relationship, I think it's also important that advocates understand the context in which they're advocating. So you're in a system, and that system has a history that was developed long before you got there. So it's really important that you understand the people that you're working with. So what's the like the hierarchical structure? Who's the person you ask for specific things? Like, do I go to my mentor with this particular question, or is that a question for the principal? Or you know, what's the hierarchical structure? And who are the people in your organization? When you work in a really large school, it's very easy to not know who all of the staff is. But if you don't know who the staff is, then you don't know who to ask for what. So I think getting to know the people is really important, forging relationships with those people. Understanding personalities. So everybody has different personalities. So with those relationships helps you understand that, you know, I have this principal and this principal likes to be approached in a particular way about something. And you can glean that knowledge from listening to interactions that your colleagues and friends have had with this person that you're going to have to go ask this thing to. And then I think also understanding politics. So understanding kind of the conflicts that have come before you and the conflicts that might push up against whatever change it is that you're trying to make is going to be really important.
I think we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these things with some of the questions I have later on for sure. And yeah. I mean, you have to know that I'm going to ask this. You talked about the 80-20 principle. So what's one change that you think will have the biggest impact?
So I can give you an example from teaching. So when I started my job, they went from having a 0.4 BOCES itinerant ESL teacher that came, you know, once or twice a week, actually, to needing two full-time ESL teachers in one day.
Wow.
So a local church sponsored a bunch of Liberian refugees, and there was like all of a sudden, you know, 40 English language learners K-12 when there had been three.
Wow.
And it was a huge shock to the system. I got hired along with another teacher to go full time. Her and I worked together for a day, and she got a call that the baby that they were trying to adopt was like on their way, and she left for maternity leave and never came back.
Oh my gosh.
So while I had been a speech teacher before, I'd never been an ESL teacher, and I'd never worked with the refugee population either. So it was like, you know, my first 6 months, I just felt like, you know, that cat poster where that cat's just hanging by like their claws and it says hang in there. I just felt like I was the physical embodiment of that cat poster probably my entire first year of teaching. And so what I noticed very quickly is that I couldn't service kids across multiple classrooms in a grade level effectively, because at the time there was no master teacher schedule in the elementary school that I worked in. And so I really needed my kids to be clustered by teacher per grade level in order to meet the minimum number of legally required minutes. And so I made that my priority. And it took me a full year of advocating before it happened. I should also say that after I left, they stopped clustering kids, and the teacher that now has my position is advocating for the same thing again. Aww. So things, you know, change is not always permanent. I think that's important to know. And so I really focused on that. So when people said, is there anything that you need? I asked for two things my first year. One, a budget for textbooks and materials, because I am a full teacher and I deserve to be treated like a full teacher. So I wanted a classroom teacher's budget for textbooks and materials, and I wanted my kids to be clustered in an identified teacher classroom so we could target PD for them and that I could schedule my kids appropriately, because I was not meeting the legally required number of minutes my first year teaching.
So this was not in my list of questions that we prepared beforehand, but how did you know how to do that stuff? I feel like some people are naturally more assertive, and that might be part of it. And we do have some questions coming up about, you know, for first year teachers or new teachers. How did you know to do that when it was your first year teaching?
So I am one of those more naturally assertive people. I very much feel like it's my responsibility as a teacher. I'm a teacher slash advocate or slash leader. I'm not just a teacher. So I've always felt really comfortable in embodying that role. I also had a lot of practice advocating for my speech students in the context of CSE, which really honed my skills that way. That this is, you know, in a team, this is how you ask for what you need for a student. And that's a negotiation process. So I think I was probably lucky in the fact that although I was a singleton teacher, when a system is in turmoil, although it's very stressful, everyone is looking for solutions. So I wasn't the only person that was thinking about how do I make things better for this particular set of students. I was really lucky enough to be in partnership with my principal at the time, who would say to me, like, what is it that you need to do your job? He was very open. He didn't always give me what I wanted, but he was open to having that conversation. And then our school was also in the midst of changing from a Basel Reader curriculum into a full balanced literacy reading and writing workshop. And so I got to be the voice of Els in that time of change. And so so I think when change happens, there's this vacuum of knowledge, and then it's your system, although it's stressful, is really ripe to step in and say, this is it. And my mantra is always been, if not you, then who? And if I can answer the who, if there is somebody else that can do this, then I don't necessarily need to step in. But in the system that I was working in, the who was me. I was the only person that knew the historical context of my kids, the social emotional supports they needed, what they had survived in their refugee camps before they came over, how they were assimilating now, what their particular educational needs were. There was no other expert, because I was a singleton. There was no other expert in my context that could offer the knowledge. And I very much believed that that was a huge part of my job. And I actually think probably for the first 3 years I had that job, my advocacy work took a higher seat than my actual teaching, because the system was in so much turmoil and because we really had to rethink what is it that this particular group of students needs from us.
Well, that is like the perfect segue into my next question. So I'm going to read you a question that I've heard from teachers before and then follow up with my kind of question that goes with it. So I've heard a teacher ask or say, when I've tried to advocate for Els in the past, I've been reprimanded for being, and I'm using air quotes, confrontational, even though I thought I was being professional. How can I advocate strongly without being considered confrontational? And that kind of goes along with my question about how can educators improve their advocacy skills?
Yeah, so there is a wonderful book. Hang on, I have it on my shelf. I'm going to grab it. So the author of the book is Jennifer Abrams, and it's called Having Hard Conversations. And I think that learning how to have a difficult conversation is one of the best advocacy skills you can teach yourself. Seeking out some professional resources and some professional help. Jennifer Abrams is an educational consultant. She does do like full day PDs around the book, Having Hard Conversations. You could do it as a PLC. There's a workbook that goes along with it. So learning how to have difficult conversations. If someone is perceiving you as confrontational, then you need to do some self-reflection about how you showed up to that conversation. Were you being confrontational, or were you overcome with emotion and that was, you know, perceived as confrontational? Are you having a conversation with a leader that views all questioning as confrontation? Are you having a conversation with a leader? And unfortunately, there are some out there that it, like, if you're not 100% with them, you are against them. So I think that's, again, where this idea of relational understanding of people comes in. Like, do you understand the people, their personalities, and the politics of the system that you're dealing with? It's also, I had a wonderful, just wonderful mentor. And she really helped me hone some of my skills, some of my advocacy skills. So when I needed to go, and I made lots of mistakes along the way. I really did. I came in too hot a couple times at the beginning, and I really got, you know, shut down. And I really needed to do some reflection about how I was approaching the people in leadership positions. No one wants to be made to feel like they're incompetent. And if you walk into a meeting, which I have done before, and say, this is the problem, 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 fix it, you're not going to get very far. So that's why I recommend really focusing on one thing at a time. That really helped me. And also by developing relationships with my leaders, I understood how they needed to be approached. So I honed my relationship with my principal, there were a couple times where I really didn't think I was in the wrong. I really didn't, but I knew that I would not be able to get anything else done for my kids if I didn't repair this breach in the relationship that I had with him. So I went into his office and swallowed my pride and apologized about things that I did not think I really had to apologize for. But the relationship was more important to me, because if it wasn't repaired, I wouldn't have been able to get other things that I needed for my kids. This particular leader, I knew he needed to be approached with solutions. So I had worked, you know, had conversations about with, you know, my trusted colleagues and with my mentor about, like, I really need to ask the principal this. What do you think the best way to do that is? And so we would kind of talk through it, and then I would role play sometimes with my mentor. And the most important thing that she taught me was, you get more flies with honey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like this, you know, when you're trying to kill flies, you attract them, you know, with, you know, or fruit flies, you attract them with like sugar water, and they go in and they drown. You know, not that I want to drown a principal, but the analogy really is that that my job is to show up kindly, professionally, and assertively, no matter what kind of chaos is going around me. And I think that takes some real self-awareness. So being a good advocate, you have to know what your buttons are, so that when they're pressed, you can identify, like, oh, this person pressed this button, or like this particular button, or this particular hang up that I have, and I'm feeling that way, and that you can either back off that conversation until you can de-escalate yourself emotionally, or you can talk yourself out of it in the meantime. You know, I've had, you know, some really, really intense confrontations and conversations, both in my teaching world and in the world of professional development. You know, humans are humans. And sometimes when humans feel threatened, they become aggressive. You know, I've had people scream in my face. I've had people, you know, swear at me. I had a leader once that threw my backpack across the classroom. He wasn't angry at me in particular. He was angry at a situation in a meeting that I was in. And it doesn't serve me to jump into that chaos. So to answer your question, I think learning how to have difficult conversations, that's a skill that can be honed. And then really learning yourself, really being self-aware. So what are your triggers? How do you react when you're in confrontation? And figuring out how to stay out of chaos when it is happening around you, because it does in large systems, and particularly systems that are under strain, are really important skills to have. And I think every teacher can learn those things.
Thank you for that. So let's like kind of go to the other end of the spectrum. I've heard a lot of new teachers or untenured teachers, teaching assistants, or in some of our larger districts, we have community liaisons. They want to advocate for L's and they're not sure how. Maybe they don't feel like they have the power or the voice. So they're kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum of the teacher who is like, I'm coming in hot and heavy and I'm telling you what these kids need. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of timidness, I think, coming from this question. So if the teacher says, I'm a first year teacher, I'm untenured, like how can I advocate in my position? I'm a TA, what can I do? Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
So I would say, let's unpack what your mental barriers are a little bit. Like, why do you feel like you don't have a voice in this? Is there something structurally that's going on? Is it personal? Like that, you know, you have a history of not being heard when spoken, and the idea of stepping out. Being an advocate is being vulnerable, right? Like you're showing up and you're asking for something. And it's a risk. It's an emotional risk. It's a professional risk. I can totally understand why people would be uncomfortable and unwilling to do that. So I would first ask those teachers to sit down with me and think about, you know, what's holding you back? And whatever's holding you back is very personal. It tends to be very personal, that there's a particular situation that happened that, that they don't feel like their voice is heard or respected anymore, or, you know, that they're timid and shy and not comfortable stepping into that leadership role. And then I think we would coach into whatever that that particular person's barrier is. In terms of first year and untenured teachers, what I would say to them is that you have just as much right to advocate for your students as any other teacher, as your 30-year neighbor veteran teacher. And sometimes you have more of a right and a responsibility, right? So the world of education changes very quickly. The voice of younger teachers, while not often listened to, I think is so important. You know, they're closer to their own education, which means that they have a much more, a different perspective on it than someone who's been out of the world, the role of being a student for 20 or 30 years. They are also coming out of teacher prep programs where they're learning cutting edge things that other teachers don't necessarily have access to. And so I would say that it's really important to hear and to encourage those younger teachers' voices. I think mentoring plays a huge role in it also. Like when you have a mentor or a coach that can help you own your voice is really important. And I also think there is this overarching fear in education of being fired. I get the untenured teacher question a lot. And if you are being professional and respectful and courteous and, you know, keeping your emotions in check when you're advocating, there's no grounds for, you know, you to be worried about, you know, what is going to happen with your job. And if you happen to work in a system where if you question leadership, that is seen as disloyalty, and you are made a target of, which does happen sometimes, I would say to you that there is a nationwide teacher shortage in STEM, special ed, and English language learners, and that shortage is only going to get larger over the next 10 years, and perhaps you need to think about finding a place to work where your voice would be heard. And there are kids that need help everywhere.
Right.
So,
right. Thank you. And so let's take it one step back even further. Sure. So what can pre-service teachers do to practice advocacy skills before they even step foot in their own classroom or in a school? What can they do?
Oh, that's a great question. So I adjunct in a couple of pre-service teacher programs. So I love thinking about this and what that might mean for like my syllabus and how I'm teaching kids. So the first thing that I would say to pre-service teachers is ask questions. Ask questions of your professors. Ask questions of the people you're doing your field work in. So whether you're doing your observation hours, your practicum placement, ask why. Why are these particular decisions being made about kids? Why is it a struggle for this kid to get their needs met in this particular classroom, but not this classroom? Ask questions. Be highly observant. Write down everything. And then the next thing I think they can do is you have to know the law. I think L rights and L that law is the other big piece of the puzzle that maybe we haven't touched on yet. So CR Part 154 are the laws that govern English language learners in New York State. You should know those laws backwards and forwards before you even step into a teaching position. Having documentation to back up your advocacy is invaluable. So you can go to a leader and say, hey, I really need you to cluster these kids because, but it's so much more effective if you say, I really need you to cluster these kids because this is best practice for research and we're out of compliance with the law, right? Like that's a, like this and to getting in compliance is really important. And so there are every single teacher hiring committee I've ever sat on has questions about CR Part 154. And CR Part 154 is not really taught in teacher prep programs. That's not what professors specialize in. They sort of expect you to know that knowledge on your own. Like, here's the website, get to know it. And so I would also say reach out to Arburn if you have any questions. There is we have a federal grant in my region called TIF, and I'm not exactly sure what it stands for, but it's pre-service teachers, and they are in a cohort, and they do a bunch of substitute teaching, and then they also get a bunch of professional development after schools. And so so if you have an opportunity to do a cohort like that, where you could make money but also be have advocacy skills, that would be great. So I think that's a really important skill also.
Well, that's a really cool program. I think like, oh, I wish somebody had said that to me when I was in my teacher prep program. I think that because of the nature of my very first teaching job where I was the only ENL teacher, I kind of just had to learn how to say like, here's what my kids need. Here's how I know that. Here's a possible solution. Just because there was nobody else who was going to do it. Like you said, if not me, who? So I think that, like you said, it's a blessing and a curse to be an ENL teacher, whether you're alone or with a team. There's so many benefits from being with a team. And there are things I think that sometimes it's just easier and faster to learn when you have to do it because you're the only one. Mm-hmm. And so for any singletons out there, our lone itinerant teachers or the only one in a district, you know, this is a really big opportunity, I think, to practice saying, here's what my kids need, here's how I know that, and here's something that I think we could do about it. Which does really kind of bring me to the majority of the districts that we have in our region, which have small numbers of elves. So oftentimes we hear teachers or administrators or, you know, any member of a school community say, we only have 2 L's, we only have 8 L's. And I think when teachers are looking at just the numbers of kids, teachers want to do the right thing, if whether there's 1 kid or 1,000 kids. Mm-hmm. So when a teacher says, well, we only have 4 L's in our whole district, who's really going to listen to me? Or what difference is it going to make if I try to advocate for them? What would you say to them?
So here's, I think, where knowing the law and some accountability stuff that like isn't typical teacher knowledge would really be important. So let's say you've got 4 L's, right? And they're in 9th grade and their graduation cohort is expected to graduate in 4 years. If you have 2 of those students that don't graduate in 4 years, your graduation rate for L's is 50%. And then you are going to have your English language proficiency measure be low on ESSA now. So understanding how school systems are held accountable for student achievement and equity, as well as CR Part 154, I think is really important. So if you approach a principal and say, you know, we really need to have this program do this, this, and this, because if we don't, these however many at-risk kids might not graduate, and then that means our graduation rate is going to be X, and then we will be starting to be looked at by the state for accountability. So, you know, in admin school, and when you go to get your admin certificate, you are taught those things. Like, you have a whole class on school law. You have a whole class about thinking about accountability measures and how, you know, different services and pots of money and things are given to schools. I think it's really important that teachers also know that information. And if they don't, or they have questions, you know, that's, I sort of think that's what ARBURN is for. Like, if you're really trying to figure out how do I advocate for this thing in particular, then you can come to us and we can help you think through what that conversation looks like. I have this conversation with school districts around students with interrupted formal education all the time. I think this is a perfect example. So for students with interrupted formal education, their requirements are the same as everybody else for CR Part 154. There's no special programs, there's no special you know, graduation measures that they get from being identified as a student with interrupted formal education. So they're required to be identified and they're required to, you know, graduate from high school. But what happens in that in between is so gray. And so the question I get all the time, which I think is very legitimate, and I don't take it personally. I know that if this were posed to some people, they would be very offended, like, oh, you don't want to do what's right by these kids. But what the question is, so identify them, then what? What's the expectation? And I say the expectation is the same for all English language learners, that you are giving them a program that meets their particular educational needs. The educational needs of students with interrupted formal education are much higher, right? They need developmental literacy and numeracy help. That has staffing implications. That has money implications. You know, it's a lot bigger than identify these kids as SIFE. They say, if I don't do that, what happens? And I say, well, here's your choice. You can do it at the beginning, or you can be made to do it on the back end. So, like, you know, you if you don't appropriately meet the needs of SIFE, they're not going to graduate from high school. They will not meet English language proficiency measure on ESSA, and it might take 2 years, but then some other office is going to come in and say, you've been identified as a school in need of improvement for this particular subgroup, and then you will have to do it. So would you rather be reactive, which is much harder to put quality programs in when you're being reactive, or would you rather be proactive? And then we can say, look at this school district, look at all the great things that they're doing. Let's highlight them. And I have had this conversation, I would say 12 times this year, and not one school has chosen to be reactive. They've all chosen to be proactive in whatever context that they have. And, you know, some schools don't have the financial resources to create a whole special program. So we look at their context and their system, we look at what the kids need, and then we try and creatively problem solve how to meet their needs in that school's particular context.
With all of these methods and suggestions that you're sharing, what is really standing out to me the most is that there just needs to be a deep knowing. There just needs to be a knowing of students and their families, first and foremost. There needs to be a knowing of our colleagues and our system, and really a deep knowing of ourselves. I think that's what's really resonating with me with everything that you're saying, is that it comes back to knowing. And so I think if teachers can figure out ways to make those connections, to do that self-reflection, I feel like that's what it all comes down to. Then you're going to know what to advocate for. You're going to know how to advocate for it. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, that's a really good way to summarize it.
So let's think of our burning question number two for this episode. We have a lot of questions about this. We get a lot of questions about this. Our burning question was, how do we center the voices of our L's and their families in our advocacy? So the first question that always comes up is, how can I center the voices of our students and their families if I don't speak their languages, or if very few people in our community speak their languages? What do I do? I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, so I think this is a perfectly appropriate place to reach out to Arburn also. So family engagement is one of our specialties. There's someone in each of our offices that specializes in family engagement. So our Arburn a couple of years ago created a family needs assessment, and we paid for it to be translated into 5 languages. And you could take the English version and translate it into a million things. I think what we get wrong with parents and families and students and their voices is that we assume that we know what they need. We never ask them what they need. Sometimes parents don't tell us because, you know, their cultural background is that, you know, schools make the decisions. And but our cultural expectations in America are that parents are equal partners in their children's education. And so that needs to be communicated to the family, that like, this is our expectation. This is, you know, we value you as a partner. And then we need to ask them what it is that we need. And I think this is another situation where relationships are key, and not just relationships with the ESL teacher, that those parents are having relationships with, you know, office staff and the nurse and the, you know, the their classroom teachers. And you can start small. By, you know, saying, you know, I am a teacher. I am telling you this in your native language. I value you as a partner. I would like you to come to the classroom. I would like you to, you know, sing songs in Spanish in kindergarten, or I would like you to come into fifth grade and teach your kids class about how you celebrate Chinese New Year, something like that. So parents feel welcome, and that they have access to school the same way as everybody else does. I think this is changing. So the advent of some assistive technologies that did not exist 10 years ago has really helped people a lot. So, you know, when I was teaching, the nurse just called home in English and said English things to families, and it didn't even occur to anybody. I mean, it occurred to me, but I just didn't know how we would get it done, that it had to be in a language that they understood. But now they have, like, you know, Propio and all of these online, these phone services that you can call and say, you know, and they have, you know, Propio and some of the other phone services, I can't remember all the other ones' names, but there are tons of them, have, you know, very low incident languages like Chin. You can call and say, I need Chin, even though, and they have someone, and then you do a 3-way call with the interpreter and your family. Now some of the classroom management tools have other languages available. So Seesaw comes in multiple languages. You can get Google Classroom in multiple languages. There's a Microsoft translation app that is quite good for, like, you know, word-to-word dictation. Those should be used in emergencies only, and you have to keep your language very simple. Like, you can't do complex and compound sentences, or it gets very, the system gets overwhelmed. There's that lovely company Talking Points that was started by an immigrant student herself. And so the parent has the Talking Points app on their phone in whatever language that they want to use, and you have it in English, and then you can text each other back and forth. So there's a lot of options, but I do think that parents need to be invited in. I think it needs to be communicated that our American education expectation is that they are equal partners and that they have the most important voice. Parents do not, even the English speaking parents, do not understand how much power they have to affect their child's educational outcomes. So much power. So parents need to be taught that. And that is a totally culturally appropriate expectation. And then the school needs to problem solve how we're going to communicate with them in a language that they understand.
And you kind of just answered the question that I was going to ask next about how do we center families' voices if they don't know much about how school works. You really addressed that. So then yeah. I do get the question often, and I don't know if this is necessarily how I've always heard it phrased, but this is kind of the message of the question. How far are we supposed to, air quotes, bend to accommodate L's and their families? Shouldn't they be learning how to adapt to the American school system? I hear that sentiment a lot when I'm working with teachers. What's your response to that?
I guess I would first ask, how are they not being, you know, enculturated or, and, you know, involved in the American school system? And for me, this is an issue of equity. Like, I love that visual with the kids in the fence and the boxes, and that everybody needs a particular kind of box. You know, equal is not fair. And we also have this other compounding issue in the United States where we very much believe in rugged individualism and, like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And if you can't figure this out, then why should I help you? But what the conversation we don't have, which is equity oriented, is that not everyone is starting at the same place. So, you know, if it's, there's this, with the rugged individualism, we're expecting that everyone, regardless of race, culture, language, class, religion, has the same starting line, and they don't. And so, you know, if you're thinking about it in visual terms, we are accommodating people so they can start at a common starting line. That's kind of how I like to think about it. And I don't think accommodating is enabling. And I think people get those two things confused. And we don't want to have what my old boss used to call pobrecita syndrome, like, oh, poor baby, I have to do all of these things for you. Our job as advocates is to empower students' voices and to empower families' voices. And there's this mistaken idea that power is finite. Like, if you give power or teach someone how to harness their own power, that is somehow taking power away from other people. And I just don't believe that's true. I've never seen a situation where that was actually the case, that when you allow people to step into their own power, which is what essentially being an advocate is. You're stepping into your voice and you're teaching students and parents how to step into their voices, that you are sharing power and helping people become the most fully realized versions of themselves. And I also don't think we would be having that conversation about white English speaking kids. No one would be asking, how far do I have to bend over for this white English speaking student? They just don't, we don't. It's very much tied to unconscious bias and these, like, you know, American ideals that we take into. And I also think this is where knowing yourself comes in, right? Like, you should know if those are some of the beliefs that you harbor, because that can get in the way of your ability to have relationships with people. And the goal, I think, for schools is to, you know, gradually release all of this to parents, that so parents can fully own it themselves, and then you don't have to spend all of this time, you know, doing all of this stuff. So if a parent can come to you and say, I'm really excited about this parent-teacher conference, I'm going to need a translator, how great would that be? I mean, that's so wonderful. They know what they ask for. They know what their legal rights are. And they know, and that takes so much pressure off the ESL teacher. Most ESL teachers I know are, you know, calling, do you need this? Do you need this for, you know, weeks before, you know, parent-teacher conferences or whatever that is. Wouldn't it be lovely if our parents felt comfortable engaging in school the way that, you know, American-born middle-class parents are comfortable in? That's my goal for them. And once they have that, my advocacy is done there. Like, I don't need to do anything else. I have released this to them and they are owning that.
I love that. And you've mentioned some of these already, but what are some kinds of questions that teachers can ask L's and their families to center their voices in their advocacy? You talked about just asking somebody, would you like to come? Would you like to do something? What else could teachers ask?
Yeah, so I think students, this counts for students and parents. I think the first step of advocacy that we talked about before is, what are your barriers? Like, this is what we expect from you. You know, this is how school works in America. What is challenging for you about this? And then how can we problem solve that together? So I have a really great example from the classroom. So I work with a very large high school in the Rochester City School District. They're predominantly Spanish speaking. So they have a very huge bilingual program. They're the largest Spanish speaking high school in this region. And they have a very large and healthy, robust ESL team. Like, they're just, they're family. They really support each other. And they often come up with really creative ideas to deal with problems. So they have been consistently having this issue where they have a testing coordinator that works in conjunction with the ESL team. And they come up with accommodations for L's for the Regents exams, because this is a high school. And so each kid is assigned to a room, and there's two proctors typically assigned, and they go to this room, and they get to the room, and the accommodations they need aren't always there. Or the proctor that's been assigned to the room is like, you know, you're not allowed to use this dictionary or whatever. And it became an issue that, like, they were having to, like, call the state and be like, you know, this kid's test has to be invalidated. I think that might have happened once. And then they realized, like, this is a huge problem, right? And we really need to think about how we can do this. So they really had two options. They could have top-downed it, where they worked with the administrator and they had a conversation with the whole staff about these are the proctoring expectations, these are the accommodations that English language learners get, la la la. But they're, you know, like I said, 80% L's. You would think that the staff already knows this, and there's so many other things going on in that building and in the district that what you have a finite amount of time with everybody. What do you take off the agenda to put that on the agenda?
Yeah.
And that's something that large systems struggle with a lot. So what they actually decided to do, this was an ESL teacher's idea, and it's freaking brilliant, and we share it with everybody. She created these accommodations cards. So it says, L accommodation card, my name is name. And then it says, CR Part 154 legally entitles me to the following accommodations. And then it's a checkboxes So translated, extended time, whatever it is that, and not every kid needs every accommodation. So what the accommodations that they're asking for are negotiated. They talk about it with the ESL teacher, and those boxes are checked on that kid's card. And then it says, if you have questions, please call my ESL teacher at this number. Every single L takes those cards to their Regents proctoring room, and they haven't had a problem since.
Wow. And so,
you know, I think that wasn't advocating for students. That was teaching students how to advocate for themselves. They could have done all of this, structural, let's change this, and then just like prayed that it worked. And they thought, let's take it to the kids and see what happens that way. And particularly for kids who regularly feel disenfranchised, having an area that they know what their rights are and that they can say to an adult calmly, kindly, with legal backing and another adult to support them, this is what I need, I think is invaluable. And I think that plants a seed in them that they have personal power that they might not have known they had, and that they can start exercising in other areas of their life.
I really love that. I'm just thinking about some kids I had in the classroom when I taught high school English language learners and how empowering that would be, because I can specifically remember particular times when there was a sub or somebody who didn't know what supports they had a right to receive and how frustrating that is. So that's really cool. I love that. Thanks for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
What can school leaders do to set the expectation of centering the voices of students and their families? We want to have leaders that we can look to who are modeling this for us. So what can they do to set that expectation?
So I really think about this all the time. I very much believe that school community and how schools operate that is set by the tone of leadership. So if leaders believe in equity, then you are having a system that's striving toward equity. If leaders believe in other things, then that's what you're focusing on. And so I think that having leaders really sit down and think about their L's, developing some empathy for them, having relationships with those students is really helpful for leaders, I think, that aren't punitive, that are like humanizing those kids and making them a part of the conversation. You can't have an equitable system for English language learners without thinking about them system-wide. So it is essential that leaders know, from the Board of Education to the superintendent to the leadership cabinets to any of the principals or APs or curriculum directors in school. And I think where we see inequitability is when those people are making decisions in silos without thinking about their student population as a whole. So I would recommend that that leaders think sort of about buckets of kids, whether it's their race or their socioeconomic status or their language status. And, for me, it's always helped me to kind of think about this archetypal student that that's kind of a compilation of a bunch of kids that I have. That so if these decisions I'm making, will they work for this archetypal student? Or if I have a particular relationship with a kid in general, I can think about that kid how are the decisions that I'm making going to affect this child? And thinking about that. I also think it's really, really important that all leaders understand L pedagogy, and they don't yet. It's not part of getting a leadership certificate. It's starting to be more included in classwork, but they don't have to know any particular knowledge about English language learners in order to be an administrator. And so understanding L pedagogy and I think the best leaders do two things. There is a top-down expectation that all students have equal access to whatever it is that, you know, they're offering in school. And so they're thinking about equity. And then the other leaders that I know what they don't know. And they know who to ask to get that information. Leadership is a big, big, complicated job. And there's no way you can be expert on everything. And L pedagogy, L programming, all of that seems to be something that people have less knowledge about. Okay, fine. But who can you ask to get that knowledge? Who are you reaching out to? Is it Arburn? Do you really trust one of your teachers? Do you have a colleague that you went to admin school with that's in a larger district that really knows about L's? Who can you ask to fill in those information gaps?
Great. Those are great suggestions. Jen, are there any organizations outside of our schools that model advocacy strongly for us that we could maybe look to as we're honing our own skills? Things like places that really center the voices of kids and their families and don't center our voices?
Yeah, so I would say that it depends on your community. I do think International TESOL, so like that organization, does a really good job teaching advocacy skills. If you go to their conferences, there's usually something about advocacy. They have toolkits and things like that that you can read. I love Diane Starfenner's book, Advocating for English Learners. I think that's an excellent place to start if you really want to think more deeply about this. And then in terms of education, I don't know a group in particular that focuses on education, but I know many, 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 many community groups that have advocacy skills for their own area of expertise. So I think it's really important that when you're thinking about, you know, learning how to advocate, that you look in the community and see what kind of resources are available to you there. So for example, Rochester has the Ibero-American Action League that is an advocacy group for Spanish-speaking individuals. They have a radio station. They have family services. They, you know, support tons of different projects in the community for the betterment of Spanish-speaking people. We have a very strong Spanish-speaking community in Rochester. And so, you know, reaching out to them and saying, you know, how, you know, talking to people, how do you advocate? How do you get information to families? And so finding community organizations, I think, that do a really good job advocating and helping people is a really good way to do that. And I think the more grassroots something is, so the more it builds from the community up, the more likely it is that students' and parents' voices are going to be centered in that situation. The more top-down it is, it seems to me that the more voices are heard are the people that are making the decisions in that organization. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So when I reach out to community, I really want to see, I want to be in touch with the people on the ground. We have a lot of migrant families in our region, and we have a very, very strong worker rights advocacy, couple of worker rights advocacy groups that have grown grassroots from farm workers up. So they organize themselves and then they find people to support them in organizing themselves. It's not people coming in from outside the community and saying, let's organize. And those organizations seem to be very strong. And so I think looking to them and saying, you know, hey, you did this. I'm really interested in how you do that. And always, 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 when large decisions are being made in your system, making sure that everyone is equally represented. Are there L voices at that table? Are there students at that table? Are there parents at that table? Are they able to express to you what it is they need? Because if they're not part of the conversation, then you're not making decisions that are best for them. Because we don't know what's best for people unless we ask.
Thank you for that. I think that my advice to anybody listening would be, after all of that, stop listening to us and go ask some questions of your kids and their families. Just find out what they need from them directly and really understand yourself and where you're coming from with all of that. Jen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I think that this is a kind of topic that people can come back to, and I think we need constant practice in doing this, especially the piece about decentering ourselves. I know that for me, that's a huge challenge that I'm constantly working on and trying to make sure, like, okay, am I doing this and making this decision because I think it's the right thing, or am I really getting the input from those that it's going to impact? So I think that these are skills that we just keep honing. I don't think it's a thing you ever stop doing.
Yes, I totally agree. And I really appreciate your thoughtful questions. This was really helpful. You know, sometimes when you're in this every day, you don't have time to stop and reflect about, you know, what does it mean? Why do you do it? And what are your priorities? So it was really helpful for me to really think about our guiding questions. And this will help me going forward. And I actually think I'm going to try and do a lot more of parents, centering parents and students' voices in particular. I have examples of pockets of that, but I don't know that we as an Auburn yet do that systematically. And I would, you know, I think it's a priority. It has to be a priority.
Thank you so much. And we'll talk soon.
Great. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode, or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.